Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, Disney brings back fire-breathing memories with a reimagining of the 70s kids' film Pete's Dragon. So we'll talk about the kids and the dragon and Robert Redford's wise grandpa period. Then we'll broaden out a little and talk about stories about kids and their imaginary or just amazing companions, be they dragons or monsters or whatever Snuffleupagus is. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Check out the NPR One app for your phone. You can use it to listen to Pop Culture Happy Hour, and it's a great way to find new shows and stories for your end-of-summer road trip. Great hand-curated podcasts and stories are always ready when you are on NPR One. Find it in your app store, NPR O-N-E.
It's dragons and monsters and imaginary friends on this week's show, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books and lately other stuff, too, for the NPR website.
And joining us this week in our fourth chair from NPR Music, Daoud Tyler Amin. Hey, what do you do over there at NPR Music?
Hi there. I, too, am a writer and editor.
Wow.
We often have, like, writer and editor offs.
I was going to say, you guys are going to have a big writer and editor off later. Pete's Dragon is Disney's latest reimagining of a past successful family film. They didn't keep much from the 1977 original about a boy and his dragon buddy. Here, the story is about a boy who loses his parents, is effectively adopted by a dragon who lives secretly in the woods, and when he's found 6 years later, has to figure out whether to join the rest of the humans and how to protect his friend now that they've both been discovered. Just for a little bit of background, it's directed by David Lowery, whose highest profile project before this was probably the very different R-rated crime drama Ain't Them Body Saints. I thought that was very interesting. The stars include Bryce Dallas Howard, Wes Bentley, Robert Redford, and the young lead, whose name, which I love, is Oakes Fegley.
It's a good name.
Oakes Fegley.
Oakes Fegley. So I'm going to start over here with the parent in our group, Stephen Thompson. You are historically kind of, you know, mixed on kind of family kids films. Some you enjoy, some you don't enjoy. Where did you come down on this one?
I went to this movie with my kids, who are now 12 and 15.
Yeah.
My 12-year-old daughter would much rather see movies in which people are murdered.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, she is absolutely not the audience
so
for this.
She gave this movie, she gave this movie a 5 out of 10.
Yeah.
And was not thrilled. For me, it's interesting. You mentioned the director, David Lowery, and somewhat of the aesthetic that he brings to this movie is what people who love this movie will call lyrical and what people who hate this movie will call dull. I found it kept teetering on the brink between the two throughout this movie. I felt there were patches of this movie that seemed very, very, very slow. But at the same time, it was pretty. Instead of Disney soundtracking, you had folk songs. And there's only one really big action set piece that's right at the end, and the rest of the movie is a little quieter. For mm-hmm. for me, I felt that it fell a little flat, and one of the reasons it fell a little flat for me is it comes like 4 months after the Disney remake of The Jungle Book, which for its flaws I found a little more visually dazzling, a little funnier. I don't know. I kind of come down right in the middle on this movie.
Okay. How about you, Daoud? What do you think?
Well, I'm going to lend some balance to what I think is going to be sort of an unfair fight and say that I kind of like this movie. I think nothing much happens in it, and it moves very slow.
Nothing much happens in it, raves Daoud Tyler me.
But I think it's kind of okay. I mean, the first thing, you mentioned The Jungle Book. I feel like every time there's a Disney movie, I actually have to remind myself these days that a Disney movie is still a thing. Like, meaning that when I was a kid, probably starting with, like, The Little Mermaid, it was just understood. Like, there's a new Disney movie. We got to go see, you know, The Lion King or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And now, to me, Disney is like Viacom, basically. Mm. Like, Disney is like,
sure.
Like, Star Wars is Disney.
Sure.
Like,
Pixar.
SportsCenter is technically a Disney
sure.
property. Mm-hmm. So it's just a strange thing to go to a theater and sit down and see the logo with the castle and the Pinocchio music and be like, oh, right, Disney. Mm-hmm. Hey, guys. But for all of that, I think lyrical is the right word. I think that the thing that you called slowness, there was something a little bit refreshing about it, just because a lot of the time I feel like movies aimed at children are shouting at me the
sure.
entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of details, visual details in particular, that they didn't have to do, that didn't really advance the story, but were some of the most beautiful parts. Every time the dragon flies, particularly one shot near the end where he sort of pierces the cloud cover, mm-hmm. little details like the dragon has a broken front tooth.
Sure.
And it hints at some kind of past trauma in a way that links him to the little boy. Stuff like that, stuff like a couple of paramedics getting distracted and dropping the patient on the stretcher that they're carrying is just like a little throwaway joke. I don't think I ever need to see this movie again. Mm-hmm. But for what it was, I think I enjoyed it.
Now, Glenn and I actually saw this movie together this weekend. Mm-hmm. So I already know what he thinks. Mm-hmm. I'm going to throw over to you. What'd you think, buddy?
All right. Well, I am not a child and I do not have children. This movie isn't made for me. Let's get that out of the way. But, let me consult my notebook here. I think I wrote down some words. Here's a word. Interminable. Cloying. Simpering. There I'm referring to all the long, wet-eyed looks every character sure. gives every other character throughout this film. Formulaic, on rails. Oh, flavorless pap! Exclamation point. Humorless. And the pacing is tectonic. Earth's plates shift faster than this movie. It didn't seem Disney to me. It seemed Disney Channel. It seemed broader, bigger, more overt, giving kids less credit for intelligence and just spelling everything out in a big way. There are two films for kids in theaters this weekend. This one mm-hmm. and Kubo and the Two Strings, which I saw yesterday. It's from Laika. It's people who brought you Paranorman, Coraline. It's everything. This film isn't. It's individual. It's specific. It feels like it has a vision behind it. It feels like it's a story that needs to be told. There's lots of familiar elements in it, but it's so gorgeous and fun and funny.
For me, it's a return to a kind of movie that doesn't get made a lot anymore. And I understand how that sounds. So let me explain sort of what I'm saying. When Dawood says that kids' movies often seem to be shouting at you, the thing that comes to mind to me is kind of fart jokes and pop culture references as kind of the entirety of what people throw at kids, even in a lot of movies that I really enjoy and that I understand that kids really enjoy. But it is also true that there is a tradition of movies for families. First of all, live action Disney movies, as opposed to like Disney for a long time started to kind of regain some of its reputation for making more interesting movies after kind of Disney movie became a way of saying like not very interesting, silly kids movie for a while. When it was coming back with those animated movies like The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and stuff like that, it was all in the realm of animation for the most part. Mm-hmm. And in the last couple of years with The Jungle Book and with some other stuff, they have started to kind of, to me, more successfully reassert themselves in live action. And I think if this were an animated movie, I think the sensibility of it would seem less old-fashioned. I think if it asserted itself more clearly as a children's movie by being animated, then I think what Glenn is talking about as its broadness, its Disney, what he called the Disney Channel-ness of it, would not seem so noticeable. I think it's noticeable in part because it's a live action movie. For me, there's always been a lot of stuff for kids whose taste runs to the kind of fun adventure movie. That's been what I have felt there's more of. What there's less of is this movie, which I agree is a little bit for a softer sensibility. It's a little bit for a softer kid, maybe. And for a kid who maybe is a little more uncertain about wanting to watch, like not every kid wants to watch a lot of fights and a lot of, you know, guy versus wizard or whatever. Some kids really do like a family story where, you know, somebody comes into a family and they kind of get to know him and everything. I guess the question that I would put to you, either Stephen or Glenn, since you more didn't like it, do you think if this movie had been better at doing what it's trying to do, would you have liked it? Or is it just, are the ends that this movie is trying to reach not ends that you think you would have ever enjoyed?
Glenn used the phrase on the rails to describe this movie. And I think what I would have really liked is some kind of surprise. And I get, like, you know, it's prettier, it's lyrical. I wanted a sense of getting something that I hadn't seen before. And so I'm not sure exactly how I would have improved it. There are a lot of scenes in this movie that are just like people staring misty-eyed at the sky to music that I found very overbearing. I don't know. I just, maybe it's a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give it to you on the music, although I was happy to hear Leonard Cohen's So Long, Marianne, in a moment where you would ordinarily hear, like, an Of Monsters and Men song, something mm-hmm. with, like, trumpets and ukuleles and people saying, oh. I don't know. I mean, the response I guess I would give to that is that, like, I wonder if the ideal audience, at least for a child for this movie, is something like the boy in the film. Mm-hmm. Meaning that, like, to me, it feels like a live-action rendering of a children's picture book. You could tell somebody the entire plot and it wouldn't really be a spoiler because it's much more about mood. It's much mm-hmm. more about visuals. There's nothing to ground it in any kind of era. Like, the original Pete's sure. Dragon was made in the late 70s.
Yeah, 77. Mm-hmm.
Set in something that looks like maybe the turn of the 20th century. This movie from 2016 could have been set in the 70s. Right. There's no yeah. smartphones in it. There's no pop culture references, like Linda said. Right. And it sort of pushes it a little bit into that realm of, like, it's maybe too highfalutin to say in the realm of, like, parable or allegory, but, yeah. like, more in the realm of, like, what you'd see in a children's picture book, which is to say that, like, you can sort of easily project yourself into it.
Yeah, and I think that part of the reason for that, yes, I think it does make it timeless, and I appreciate that about it. And there are certain movies where if you go back and watch them, you're like, ooh, that could have only come out in 1996 because right. it's got that Smash Mouth song or whatever. right. I don't even know if that's the right year of the Smash Mouth song. But the reason for that felt like it was pushed by the story. Like, it had to be set when people didn't have cell phones with cameras in them. It had to be set where, like, anyone with the internet could have figured out that even in this fairly uncharted forest, you're probably going to notice a dragon, even one that can turn invisible.
Right.
It felt, on one hand, it was like, oh, this is nice. It's kind of, it's a little bit like Stranger Things, where it's like, wow, I'm watching something that's set in 1983 and I'm being transported to 1983. But I felt like that was, as much as anything, pushed by the action and in the story. Like, if people had cell phones, everyone would know about this dragon.
Not just the story beats. It is the pacing. This is a very slow-moving film, and young kids, who you're saying it's really intended for, would not sit through this thing in a mile.
I mean, to be fair, I sat in a fairly full theater. There were lots of little kids, and there was not as much squirming. Like, I could feel every time my seat squeaked,
yeah.
but I didn't necessarily feel like the movie lost the room, and there were a lot of little kids in that crowd.
Oof.
I feel like kids are entitled to corny movies as a part sure. of being a little kid. And I feel like part of your storytelling experience as a young kid is hearing stories that, to an adult, seeing them through the lens of all of their adult experience and all of their movie watching experience and story experience, are going to seem hackneyed.
I do think it's worth bringing up, and we don't usually necessarily talk about this, but this film was very, very well reviewed.
Yeah.
Like, it got almost across the board rave reviews. There were a lot of people who had the same reaction to it that Linda did. And I think a lot of people who see a lot of movies, actually, like, seeing a lot of movies made a lot of people more likely to like this film. I think because that quietude can be refreshing for people who see a lot of kids' movies. Maybe my kids have aged out of where I could fully appreciate that. Like, I didn't have to see, you know, every single animated movie that's come out in the last few years, because that's not what my kids are interested in as much. But I think I'd be interested in asking somebody like Guy Raz, who has, like, younger kids, like, how did you feel? Was this movie refreshing to you? Because I think a lot of people reacted the way Linda did.
Can we talk about the first scene of this movie?
Talking about the opener, how they set up the...
This is the origin story. This is the patented Disney
right.
childhood trauma
you lose
scene.
Your parents.
That's right.
Yeah.
To your point, Linda, about something sort of, I guess you'd say, grounded in children's experience, or at least, you know, the director's idea of children's experience. The thing that struck me about that scene is how much it is about the perspective of the kid, meaning mm-hmm. that all of the shots of his parents
yeah.
originate from a low angle in the back seat. When the car flips over, the camera is fixed to the car. You don't see the car actually flipping. It's all a shot of the child and everything spinning around him, but his world is stationary. There's something idealized to the way that he looks at those moments. And you see later on, he actually sort of projects those memories onto his new guardians and his new
sure.
protectors.
When I read the production notes, they talk a lot about how they wanted it to be a story about kids trying to figure out sort of where you belong. It's not that it's a new notion for a kids' movie, but for me, there is some emotional complexity in the yearning that he has after he's been off being raised by the dragon, that he has this very conflicted yearning to be with people. Mm-hmm. And that when he sees people, he sort of, on the one hand, is running away from them, and on the other hand, is drawing them to him. And he kind of can't figure out which of those things to pursue because he kind of wants both. He wants to stay in the woods and he wants to have family. All right, I'll be curious to hear how many of you listening have maybe seen this movie or taken kids or gone on your own. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you think. When we come back, Pete has his dragon. We're going to talk a little bit about kids and their monsters and their imaginary and or fantasy friends. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from DreamWorks Pictures, presenting The Light Between Oceans, a drama about faith, morals, the decisions we make, and the lengths to which one couple will go for love. Based on the best-selling novel by M.L. Stedman, the film is written for the screen and directed by Derek Cianfrance, starring Academy Award nominee Michael Fassbender, Academy Award winner Alicia Vikander, and Academy Award winner Rachel Weisz. Once you find love, can you ever let it go? The Light Between Oceans, in theaters September 2nd.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. In our first segment, we talked about the Disney film Pete's Dragon, in which a boy makes friends with a dragon, and it got us talking about how common these stories seem to be, kids who befriend monsters and giants, so we thought we would talk about some examples. Now, Daoud is the one who came to us, sort of the idea for this topic. Talk about a couple of the examples that you mentioned.
There's so much to talk about, but I actually want to start with a cultural artifact. Jess, could we hear clip number one?
My pet monster.
He's bigger than big.
When he fights battles, he always wins.
And he's your friend, too.
He breaks his chains.
Put him on you and break away, too.
With my pet monster, you're busting loose.
He's big.
And scary.
And helps people, too.
And he's your friend, too.
My pet monster plays all day.
Tough.
Awesome.
Looking great.
And all your friends will want him for their friend, too.
My pet monster has breakaway chains from Amtoy, an American greetings company.
Wow, that
looking
is
great.
So that is circa 1986. This is slightly before my time. I actually grew up with Bruno the Bad Dog, which was a profoundly stupid toy of a similar ilk. We can talk about that later. But that sets up some of the ground rules, right? This was a doll marketed to boys based on the idea of having some kind of a pet monster. And it tracks along some of the lines that you see in stories like this. Usually young boys as the protagonists. Usually the monster presents in some kind of quote-unquote masculine way. And there's an element of protectorship, maybe mutual protectorship, where the child is in need of a companion or a protector. And in the course of things, they come to be the protector of whatever fantastical creature you want to talk about. So, I mean, there's lots of these. There's E.T. There's you can make a case for Hobbes from Calvin and Hobbes. The Iron Giant. Yep.
BFG.
BFG, for sure.
From earlier this summer.
Big Hero 6.
It's really funny. They actually, Glenn and I saw Pete's Dragon at the Alamo Drafthouse, where they always sort of do, like, related material before the film. And they showed the E.T. trailer. And it does have a lot of really similar ideas in it, I think.
I got the trailer for a movie called Monster Trucks, which was Lucas Till with
the new MacGyver.
That's right. As a high school senior with a pet alien who helps him win drag races, I think.
Wow. Holy moly. Yeah. My approach to this, you know, very often, anytime I look at something and it feels to me like there's a bunch of examples of it, I start looking for what's the ancient example? Like, what's the sort of hundreds and hundreds of years old example? I couldn't find a kind of a precise equivalent, but it was interesting that you talked about kind of the mutual protectorship, because the closest that I could get was kind of Androcles and the Lion, which is the story about he's a slave and he meets up with the lion and removes a thorn from the lion's paw, helps the lion, and later he's in a situation where the lion is supposed to eat him and the lion chooses not to eat him. So it's kind of this, the mutuality of mercy story, as they describe it.
Right.
There are a lot of those. There are a lot of examples of those. There's also a version of that where it's a mouse and a lion. But these monster examples, which do tend to have that idea of kind of the big scary thing, whether it's a dragon or a whatever, are a little bit different.
Yeah, and there's also imaginary friend things versus monster things. And there's a lot of crossover there. And it just lists on the internet of just imaginary friend movies just goes on for on and on.
Sure.
Because a lot of horror movies, especially some of the kind of premiere, the big name horror movies, start out as the kid has an imaginary friend. Oh, wait. The Shining, right. The Exorcist, Sinister, Poltergeist. They all play
tons
with
tons
that.
Babadook a little bit.
And yeah, it's tough. I was reaching for a taxonomy, but there's just so much crossover here. I mean, you can have an imaginary friend like Harvey or an imaginary friend like Donnie Darko or whatever that rabbit's name
Frank.
Is. Frank, thank you. Both bunnies, very different. In terms of imaginary friends, though, I think there is one that lives in the memory. So, Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street, Big Bird's quote-unquote imaginary friend, except,
right.
Of course, we know, viewers knew, that he wasn't imaginary, he was real. But the adults on Sesame Street never saw him, and that stayed that way for 14 years, 17 seasons, until finally, on November 18th, 1985, it was a Monday. It was also Christian Siriano's birthday. finally, they saw him, and it sounded a little something like this.
At last! Oh, joy, joy! I told you there was a Snuffleupagus, and last, you've seen him, and you gotta believe it, right? I told you all along that there was a Snuffleupagus, my best pal. He's not imaginary, but you never believed me.
No, but Maria and Linda and I believed you, Big Bird.
Yeah, but the rest of you didn't.
All right, so Big Bird being a little vindictive there. Big Bird holds a grudge.
Big Bird is like, eat it, people of Sesame Street.
But, I mean, I was in high school when that happened, but...
still watching, I'm
still,
sure.
I mean, it was a big day. It made the news. It was a Monday, and it was the first show of the week. And if you were a kid who prized being right about things, that moment must have been such a... I mean, I wonder if there was kids who actually saw that happening for the first time and just... Because, again, I would be just as vindictive as he was.
Yeah, it's interesting. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at how many of these movies, and as Dowd said, like, there is such a massive... catalog to draw from. It's hard to even wrap your head around it, but to me the ones that are most striking and common are movies and shows where they're meditations on loss or outsiderhood, and that like a movie like Big Hero 6 where the...
Oh, you mean like Pete's Dragon? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that brought that up is that Pete's dragon, the dragon is a replacement for the parents. I mean, orphaning is so common in these things, in part because you want to give the kid agency to run around and have adventures without parents being like, what? I mean, the BFG, it's an orphan. You know, it's very often the monster is a stand-in for a figure who is lost or missing. In Big Hero 6, it's a brother. You have a lot of opportunities then for emotional resonance.
Right.
And then in a lot of these other things, it's like the kid is misunderstood. The Iron Giant is a perfect example of that. You know, and there's a single mom there, but he's just this little pipsqueak with a chipped tooth, and the kids pick on him, and all of a sudden he has access to this massive giant robot. There's a certain element of like wish fulfillment in a lot of those for kids. You know, and obviously the loss is a more specific kind of wish fulfillment. You know, if a kid whose parents are splitting up, or who a parent has died, or a sibling has died, this monster comes in as a stand-in. But I think very often for that wish fulfillment payoff, there's that kid who's a nerd, who's picked on or whatever, and all of a sudden has like a protector.
There's some kind of message about vulnerability embedded into all of these. I'm sorry, Glenn, I cut you off.
No. It's just that, as you were saying, a lot of these are little boys. I mean, there's the girl in
BFG.
Monsters, Inc.
And BFG.
But a lot of these are little boys, and I think it's very telling that that commercial you just played, one of the random words thrown out was tough. It's all incredibly gendered. It's interesting.
When Dawood and I were talking about this the other day, and again, trying to figure out like how broad this would get, to me, the story of the Iron Giant, as Stephen explained it, is almost the same story as the high school movie My Bodyguard.
Yeah. Yes.
That movie, if you've never seen it, it's really lovely. It's a 1980 movie where you have kind of like a skinny, smaller kid who is threatened and picked on and is also told by very young Matt Dillon, the high school bully, there's this other kid who he's going to really get you. He's the scary one. And so I think it's you're supposed to pay me to protect you from this other big dude. But then he goes over to the big dude, played by a very young Adam Baldwin, and finds out that the big dude is just a hurting dude who also needs a friend. And so it's a very, very similar story. So I think there's something about that idea of companionship and protectorship and discovering that the big scary thing also needs some kind of companionship and some kind of, as we were talking about before, mutuality of mercy and things like that, and that you can create a kind of a symbiotic relationship even with something that is presented as potentially a threat to you, whether it's a giant or a bigger person, you know, a bigger kid, somebody who you're told to treat as a bully when you're in high school.
Right. The essential tension seems to come from a crossover between worlds, right? You start out with some kind of equilibrium, which might be unpleasant, but whether that's, you know, social castes in high school or, whether that's just like our reality and some other reality where there are dragons or aliens or whatever. And then something happens and one of the parties crosses over into the other. Usually it's the monster or whatever it is coming into our world, and that directly leads to its endangerment. I mean, that's how the protector relationship usually comes about, is because, you know, now people know about this thing and I have to do something about it.
Yeah, it's interesting to me to wonder, Glenn talked about the fact that they're mostly boys. It's interesting to me to wonder if these are stories about coming to terms kind of with vulnerability, that maybe the reason why they're, I mean, obviously one reason stories often involve boys is stories involve boys, right? But it's possible to me that girls perhaps are more socialized to be more comfortable with the idea of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. You sort of assume your own vulnerability, right? You're not expected necessarily to proclaim toughness in the same way that some boys, not all boys certainly, but I think some girls feel less pressured to project toughness than some boys do.
Well, certainly one of the theories is that by taking something that scares you and making it a monster that you hang out with or a toy that you hang out with, you are personalizing it, you're humanizing it, you're reducing it, you're making it comfortable. I don't buy that theory because if that were true, I would have grown up with a pet or doll like Snake and just to kind of, you know, take the fear out of it. I would, that's the last thing I want. That would terrify me.
Yeah.
Well, I do think as we're talking about what these stories are stand-ins for, I mean, the monsters themselves and the way that they are threatened by our world is very often a metaphor for immigration and fear of any number of things. And, you know, it usually gives the storyteller an opportunity to impart a lesson about, like, about adult humans' fear of outsiders, whether it's, you know, the fear of the communists in the Iron Giant, or it gives you a lot of opportunities for grander messaging.
Sure, you get environmentalist stories there, too, kind of where the real monsters
And Pete's Dragon has some of that, and E.T. has some of that. I think of E.T. as sort of a turning point for stories like that, where you, and I could be wrong about that, it could be just was for me, but this idea that a segment of the kind of like legitimate non-evil seeming adult world, the bureaucratic adult world, as opposed to necessarily the scheming adult world, is the enemy of, you know, whatever friend or outsider, as Stephen said, whatever you're kind of aligning yourself with.
Yeah, but there's also, there's readings where you could get a gay reading out of these things too. I mean, like in Harry and the Henderson and E.T., it's about taking this thing and having it blend in and having it not stand out and have it be hidden away so that the neighbors don't know. I mean, you could get a gay reading in anything. But it's there.
I think that's right.
I'm fascinated by how age functions in these stories as well. Yeah. In most of these stories, there are adults who get it and they're in the minority, and then there are the adults who don't. And, you know, that becomes the engine by which the laws of our reality cannot sustain the existence of this creature.
Right.
Donnie Darko is actually a really weird example of this, because that is an imaginary friend in the idiom of something resembling a social disorder or mental illness.
Right.
And that's in part because the director was trying to tell a different kind of story, but it's also Donnie Darko is 15, 16, and it's such a different thing from, you know, like a 5-year-old telling you that they have an imaginary rabbit friend who tells them to do stuff isn't as much cause for concern.
Right. I was reading some research yesterday, some actual like little abstracts of papers about, you know, there's been a ton of research into kids and monster stories and how to deal with kids, you know, who are afraid of monsters, that there are different things that work for little kids versus older kids, that depending on age, some respond better to like a concrete idea of like, let's spray the room with monster spray versus let's pretend the monster is nice. And they respond to different kinds of stuff. And there's, you know, there's tons of as I said, research and scholarship around the whole idea of kids and scary stories and the role of fear and the role of coming to terms with fear. But it was interesting to me that it's such a specific, you know, the idea of a monster friend. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happens in Pete's Dragon is there is at one point a very explicit explanation of what this kind of story is about. This is what Glenn was talking about, that things are very spelled out, which I think how much that bothers you may depend on whether you're envisioning a small kid or Glenn.
If you were a kid and your parents tried that let's pretend the monster is friendly jazz on you, you would not buy that, right? You want you want a monster spray. Oh, you want product.
Here's the thing. You're older. Yes. My recollection of the research that I was looking at was that kids who are a little bit older, and by older, they mean like five.
Yeah, wow.
Respond better to let's do something concrete.
Yeah.
Whereas kids who are littler are more comfortable are more comfortable something abstract. Stay with me for 1 second. Mm-hmm. It was also talking about how the entire idea of monsters and the idea of imaginary friends are sort of both connected to the development of abstract thinking. Mm-hmm. So when a kid is starting to say there's a monster under my bed, they're scared of it, but they're also starting to be able to envision that things exist that they can't see, mm-hmm. and that things exist that have their own rules that you might not fully understand, but you know that they exist. And it's the same thing with an imaginary friend. You're able to envision, because until a certain age, you're not able to envision a friend that isn't in front of you, a specific friend, mm-hmm. like a specific, like, I imagine a girl of this age who looks this way, or a monster that has this kind of eyes and nose and face and mm-hmm. stuff like that. I cannot wait to hear all of the stories that we forgot. Again, we're not writing a Wikipedia page. I'm sure we left out your favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to us about your favorite monsters and imaginary friends and monster stories. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of This Week and Every Week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Roadie, the first on-the-way delivery network that connects people who have items to send with drivers heading that way. Roadie is an easy, convenient, and cost-effective way to get door-to-door delivery for items big and small. Roadie lets you track deliveries in real time and offers up to $10,000 in protection on every shipment. Get a free estimate in seconds. Download the Roadie app on iPhone or Android device or visit roadie.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
It has been such a fascinating weekend leading into this week for music. At NPR Music, we have spent days and days and days trying to wrap our head around what Frank Ocean is doing.
Uh-huh.
And it started with, I mean, first of all, it has started with weeks and months of hints and clues and little snippets and website Easter eggs. And finally, what we think is going to be the album comes out, and it's this 45-minute visual album called Endless, which you can get through Apple Music. And, you know, just this that kind of frustrating, like, you have to use this service to get it, and that's not the album we were supposed to get. But NPR Music spent the weekend writing about it. Here's the new Frank Ocean. Then there's a whole, like, another Frank Ocean record called Blonde, which may be Blonde with an E, maybe Blonde without an E. And is that the album? Maybe there's another album. Finally, I wanted to talk about it. I've listened to Blonde. I like it. Part of what I like about it is it's very mysterious. You're going to have to spend a lot of time with it. It's like the Kanye West record where you need to listen to these different iterations of it to fully wrap. Finally, I'm like, you know what? I want to talk about the final concert by the Canadian band The Tragically Hip.
Yes, sir.
Didn't see
finally,
that coming.
Finally, yeah, a little hairpin turn here, because I think it's lovely that albums have become more fungible and mysterious. I think that's great. But over here, okay, the story of The Tragically Hip. The Tragically Hip is a Canadian band. They've been around for like 30 years. If you are a Canadian, this band is like U2 and Pearl Jam and the Rolling Stones and what, I mean, like, the band is absolutely massive in Canada, and they have tried and tried and tried again to break big in the United States. It just never happened. But in Canada, still a huge, huge band. Sadly, the lead singer of The Tragically Hip, a guy named Gord Downie, earlier this year announced that he has inoperable brain cancer. He's dying. And the way that the band has dealt with it is to give a farewell tour that has culminated in this one last show over this last weekend that basically stopped Canada in its tracks.
I heard somewhere that a third of the population of Canada listened to or watched it because they simulcast it on the CBC.
Yeah, on the CBC. And it was this, it's like this epic 3-hour concert. And at one point, Gord Downie just breaks down in tears at the end of the song. I mean, it is this massive, like, valedictory address, eulogy, farewell. I'm such a sucker for people in that incredibly sad situation kind of taking the reins of it and controlling it, and him being able to receive that love and appreciation from what has become like almost a kind of a defiant community around this band. And this, like, loving this band is part of being Canadian to a lot of Canadians. And I found it to be a beautiful story. And like, you had all these beginnings and endings at the same time. It just felt like such a really interesting weekend to be a music fan.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. One of them is a Twitter bot. But Glenn, you say Twitter bots are a blight on the land. Most of them are. Not magic realism bot. It's spelled exactly as it says. Every 2 hours, a bot puts together a sort of logline, a plot of a magic realist novel. For example, a Tibetan watchmaker finds out the price of winter. A whodunit in which the killer turns out to be George Eliot's Middlemarch. A queen is committed to a psychiatric hospital located in a violinist in Morocco. So amid all this kind of dreck that fills your feed, people
sure.
arguing about politics, whatever they're arguing about, this just kind of a little mm-hmm. like that in the middle of the day, every 2 hours,
yeah.
like clockwork. I love it. A magic realism bot. The second thing is a movie that I missed out on when it came out in 2014. It's called The Guest. It stars Dan Stevens, and it's directed by Adam Wingard, who did a film I really like that I talk about on the show called You're Next. This is what he did after that. The premise is that Dan Stevens plays this mysterious soldier who shows up at this family's house because their son has been killed in the war, and he says he's a buddy. Things take a very pulpy, extremely fun direction from there. It's kind of reminded me of movies like Last Seduction and Red Rock West, movies I like a lot. I never understood why Dan Stevens left Downton Abbey. He played Matthew on Downton Abbey. It was a very cushy gig. You'll leave that to go to this movie where you play basically the god of sex. In this movie, he is raw carnality. He is.
Did you not know that when he was on Downton Abbey?
I just never noticed the guy. He's doing light Hugh Grant. He's playing blonde Hugh Grant on Downton Abbey. And then, holy crap, this dude has creepy facial symmetry. He's arresting to look at.
You're the last to know.
I know. I missed out on this. That's The Guest, a very fun film.
So Glenn Weldon's news this week, Dan Stevens, good looking.
Not just good looking.
Liked it. No, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Oof.
The Guest. A movie that you liked very much. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Dawood Tyler Amin, what are you into this week, buddy? What is making you happy?
All right. I'm late on this one. Don't at me, please. I have not kept up with video games, but I've taken an interest in mobile games in the past year or so, just because smartphones are advanced enough now that they can run some pretty impressive mm-hmm. stuff. And there's a game called Limbo, originally released for Xbox in, I think, 2010, made its way to the iPhone, where I finally found it 6 years later. It is a 2D side-scrolling platformer, Glavin. And speaking of children in dangerous places, you play a boy who is wandering a sort of purgatorial underworld looking for his sister. It's beautiful to look at. It has this black and white film grain effect. There's all kinds of shadows and fog, and those are hiding some very unpleasant things. The gameplay is what's been called a trial and death model, where you run into a trap and the way that it kills you is so gruesome that you're like, all right, I'm not trying that again. But there's no timer. There's no game over. You try things until they work. It's really strangely relaxing, and figuring out how to make a puzzle not kill you is really, really gratifying. That company, Play Dead, just released the follow-up game Inside this summer. I can't play it because it's only on Windows and PlayStation right now. If that interests you at all, check out Limbo. That's on iOS, Android, most major video game systems, etc.
Limbo.
Nice.
Thank you very much. So I got one quick one. Was having a day at the end of the last week when I was, I have my anxious days, and reached out to a friend and said, what should I listen to having an anxious day? He said, Robin. So I'm taking it back. This is why I keep the best consultants in my phone.
Yep, concur.
And then the other thing that I would mention, when I was at press tour, kept hearing from friends who are critics about how much they like Superstore, which is an NBC, very sitcom-y sitcom about the staff of like a Walmart. It's essentially a Walmart. It's called Cloud Nine. I decided that I would sit down and catch up on I couldn't figure out exactly how many there were. It turns out there had been 11 in the first season, and then they just ran another special one for the Olympics in the last few days. And it stars America Ferrera, your lovely Ugly Betty, and of other wonderful projects, and also Ben Feldman, who you might know from Mad Men or A to Z. He's kind of been looking for a project that would stick and kind of be good enough for how charming and lovely he is. They are kind of the leads, but then also Mark McKinney is the boss. And it is very sitcom. It is kind of a throwback, even though it is a single cam show, it feels like a multicam show. It feels like old sitcoms in a way that I found positive without the kind of oppressive production values and audible laughing and all that stuff that tends to make multicams feel hokey and old-fashioned to people. But it still has a kind of broad, fun, silly sensibility, while also being surprisingly incisive at times about the fact it has this like very diverse cast, which is such a kind of like goofy thing to say without more context. But the context for that is that the stories they tell about that cast are pretty interesting. There is a guy who uses a wheelchair, and he goes through, there's an episode about the company doing a magazine profile for like the company magazine. So the person comes and visits, who is played, by the way, by Eliza Coop, if you need a recommendation. She comes and she's going to write up the store, and then they're going to be on the cover. And the guy in the wheelchair knows they're going to try to get a picture of him to use on the cover of the company magazine. And he spends the entire episode dodging the photographer because he's like, you're not using me on the cover of your stupid magazine. And that's like a more interesting, it's an interesting kind of thing to do with that character. But then, like everybody else, he also just gets up to kind of miscellaneous hijinks a lot of the time. Superstore. I found it on demand on my cable outlet. I think it's probably on Hulu. I think it's on a lot of different platforms, so you'll be able to find it to stream. And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, or Glenn at GH Weldon, or Daoud at Art Sorority. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thank you to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
This week, we're conducting a brief survey to learn more about who's listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour and how you're using NPR podcasts. Please visit npr.org/pchhsurvey to complete the survey. It would really help us out. Thank you so much.